Welcome to Fresno's Best Podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Maddox. Today we're talking about something that quietly shapes our daily lives in Fresno, our trees. From the ones lining our streets and shading our homes to the big aging trees that define entire neighborhoods, trees are one of the most important and misunderstood parts of our city. My guest today is Ian Ashby, a board-certified master arborist and a consulting arborist based here in Fresno. Ian helps homeowners, cities, insurance companies, and even attorneys understand what's actually happening with their trees, when they're healthy, when they're under stress, and when well-intentioned care can actually make things worse. We talk about everything from Ian's favorite hot pot restaurants to pruning myths, urban canopy planning, soil compaction, mulching mistakes, and why Fresno's trees so often suffer at the hands of bad trimming practices. If you ever wondered why your tree looks sick, why topping is such a bad idea, or how Fresno could rethink its urban forests for a hotter future, this conversation is for you. Let's go meet Ian Ashby. Blessed to infiltrate the pod waves on infinite quests, investigating, making convos to elevate guests. Politics, religion, culture, art, music, show some respect to the best little city left in the U.S. Fresno's best! Fresno's best. Ian, where do you like to eat in Fresno?
Oh, I've lived in Fresno my whole life, so I've explored so much of it. But I guess right now, whenever there's special occasions like Sichuan Hot Pot off there, I think it's like Shaw and West. But then there's Tamari, and Saison is a new one I got to go try. But my favorite place is no longer open. My favorite place was Fasica. It was an Ethiopian restaurant.
Yes.
I loved going there, but I don't know what happened to them. I saw them recently, though. I saw a trailer with all their designs on it in a Winco parking lot. So I was hoping that they were going to open a food truck, but
yeah, maybe they're doing catering. That's what I heard was the rumor. I also talked to the guy, I forget his name, but he was talking about getting some kind of brick and mortar downtown. That must have gotten whatever in the ether of transitions. But yeah, I miss their food too. It's not, having a good Ethiopian place in town, I feel, is a necessity. What did you like to eat there? What were your favorite things?
Oh gosh, I didn't really care what it was. It was all good. Honestly, it's been a little while for me to remember a specific dish. I just really like spicy food. And of course, eating it with your hands with the bread that they give you. Funny story with that. When my wife was pregnant, we went there and the guy that was working there said, oh, a lot of women come in here to have our berberry sauce, I believe it is. They said that they come in here and eat it purposely because it can induce you within 24 to 48 hours.
Oh,
and
wow.
So we're like, you should be due like tomorrow, like that's due date. So she's like, and he gave us some extra to take home. We were putting it on our eggs. And sure enough, within 24 to 48 hours, she went into labor. We're like, oh, we want to go and tell him like it. Here's another testimonial.
Your medicine works.
Yeah.
Another question. How would you describe the experience of hot pot to someone who hasn't done that before?
Yeah, hot pot's a lot of fun. I think it's a really fun date night thing to do. It's very interactive. It's shabu over at Yoshino's, where they give you a pot of broth, and then you can choose your fixings that you want to put in, vegetable plates, or if you want to put in different meat plates, things like that. And a fun thing about Sichuan is that they can give you multiple kinds of broths that you can choose from, so you have different flavor profiles with it. And it's just fun and interactive. Sometimes it gets a little messy. Sometimes people are like, oh, I don't want to have to cook my own food. But I'm like, it's fun.
Yeah, you go to restaurants at the end of the day for the social experience as much as the food. And I've had a lot of fun at Hot Pot. I don't do it that often, but when I do it, it is a lot of fun.
Yeah.
I agree with you. So we're going to talk all things trees today. I'm really excited to dig into this because I live in an older home with a lot of trees, and trees are one of the most beautiful things in the world, but they're also things that require a lot of care. And so we're going to balance the conversation in that way. But before we get started, can you talk a little bit about what the process is like to become an arborist, if you're starting from scratch, if you will?
Yeah. So it's not too difficult. There's different avenues that you can take. Either you can have a higher education, say like a bachelor's or a master's in it, but then you also need some in-field experience that can be verified. So you can't just get a bachelor's and go become an arborist. Like, you need to go out and work a bit and then have that experience verified. Then you have to take a test once everything's verified. And then once you pass that, you have to sign a code of ethics. So you can't become an arborist without saying, yes, I'll adhere to the rules of the International Society of Arboriculture. And if you go against those code of ethics, just like the Hippocratic Oath, probably for doctors, you could lose your that certificate. So that actually does mean something to say, yeah, you are an arborist. And then after that, you can specialize in so many different things. There's different classes you can take, different specialties you can go down. You can advance from like just a regular arborist to a board certified master arborist, which is what I am. And then you
Why did
become.
you want to pursue that extra level of certification?
I was already in the plans for it. I just really like knowledge and education. And that was just another thing to help push and direct me to learn more. And at a certain point, I had just had enough other certifications and experience where I was like, yeah, I'll get it. I feel like it's a little weird to be 31 and considered a master at something. I don't know. It's just the name they chose, but I was like, okay. But I usually just refer to myself as an arborist. Like most people don't understand the distinction between regular arborist and a master arborist.
Yeah, that makes sense. Let me kick you a scenario. Let's say you got two houses, similar trees, and someone hires a tree trimming crew off Facebook Marketplace, and then another one hires one with a certified arborist that works with them. What are you going to see in terms of difference in how they approach things, you think?
If they're a really good arborist, they will actually tell you whether or not your tree needs to be trimmed or not.
Yeah. So the primary difference is in what you're saying is that you're getting consulting and you're getting someone that understands the life cycle of the tree versus someone that's just going to come in and with chainsaws and a bunch of guys on a Saturday and just tear it up, if you will.
Very much, yeah. And you might also notice they don't cut as much off of your tree. So they'll actually adhere to what is known that's good for trees in arboriculture based off age and species. They might not come in and basically make your tree bald like I usually see around town where there's just like a couple little sticks sticking out of these topped ends. And it's like,
Yeah.
if you're, yeah, that's
It's very sad. Let's go ahead and dig in because I've got a lot of tree questions. We're just going to kind of power through a bunch of these right now. So we've had higher temperatures and droughts on and off for the last 15 years. What makes some trees better able to withstand all that stress than others?
a lot of trees have certain mechanisms in them that allow them to tolerate higher temperatures, even colder temperatures, but for our area, higher temperatures. So they'll actually modify a lot of their parts, like their leaves. They'll start getting smaller leaves, smaller surface area, you'll lose less water. There's something called a cuticle, which is like kind of like this waxy film on the leaf. So that waxy film plugs up these little pores on the leaves that allows water to escape from the tree. So that also helps reduce the amount of water lost. Some trees, one of them, which is really neat, is called a palo verde. So that's just Spanish for green stick. You might see them, they have the yellow flowers. The entire thing is green, like the bark is green. So what they can be is they can be summer deciduous. So if they get super stressed by drought, they'll actually drop all of their leaves in the summertime. But they're like, oh, wait a minute, I thought trees need leaves to make food. Well, that's why their bark is green. It has chlorophyll in the bark so they can still photosynthesize from the sun and make themselves sugars, but they're not going to lose a huge amount of water out of their leaves. And yeah,
Interesting. Is there a difference if a tree experiences like one really bad summer versus repeated really bad summers? Does it start to change the tree if it's a repeated stressor versus a one-off acute situation?
That's the interesting thing about trees. I always say they live slow, grow slow, and die slow. So if they're exposed to a certain environment long enough, they might start, depending on the species, they might start changing the way that they transport water in themselves, the way that they release water. The amount of, they're called stomata, those little pores I mentioned on the leaf, they can open and close those so they can actually change how much that they're going to be losing. But for many species in our area, this is why redwoods are no longer probably a good idea. Repeated stressors like that eventually leads to the decline of a tree, and then you start getting pests and disease issues. And that's usually when people call me out as a consulting arborist, be like, what's wrong with my tree? I was like, well, it's got a disease, but it's also not been watered well for a long time, so now it's just sick and can't fight off anything anymore.
Yeah, that was going to be you anticipated my next question, which was about pests. Let's say you move into an older home in Fresno and there's existing redwoods on the property or something. Is there anything that you can do to kind of slow that invasive process down or prevent pests in any way? Or is it more of a situation where you just need to cut your losses and just move on from the tree?
Yeah, I tell my clients a lot, like, we inherit the problems of the people before us in tree care
Yeah.
because trees live so long. There's been a lot of owners and it's just been handed to the next person. So you have no idea what the last person did. Sometimes it's if it looks a little sick, like the crown is looking a little thin, maybe the leaves aren't a nice green color. They're maybe looking a little dusky, or you're seeing some limbs dying back. I'd say at least start with watering it more. You can always check to see if you're getting enough water penetration in your soil. You can run your hose for, say, 20 minutes, not full bore, but then take a shovel and dig down where you had that and just see if that water's gone down 6 to 10 inches. And you're like, okay, I know that's how long I need to run it. Do that all the way around the tree, not just one little bubbler in one spot. And then you can try at least giving it some fertilizer, because once a tree gets a disease, it's very hard to cure. It's not like us where
Yeah.
it's, oh, I feel sick, and then the doctor can give you something to help you with your nausea or anything like that. It's very hard to get rid of something.
There's a tree on my block that I walk by every day. I walk my dog or whatever. And one of the limbs got chopped real severely. And now it has that epicormic growth that I call it salad fingers, where it's got it looks like a cut off limb, but it's got these tiny branches that are coming out of that single limb. What is going on there? Is that a bad thing? What's happening?
Yeah, so that's a stress response. That's the tree basically saying, where's my head? You chop my head off. I need to make a new head. So trees, they grow towards the sun. Like, they want to grow up and out. They want to get big. And so if you go and you destroy that nice tapered look that branches are supposed to have from big, and then they go and they form all the way out to the skinny little tips of the ends. And then you go and you chop that off too extremely, like you don't cut it back to another good lateral branch that can take over that dominant apex part of the limb, then you'll get all that water sprouting. And that water sprouting is basically the tree saying, I don't know where I'm going. So I'm going to start producing as much as I can to say, to establish a new leader. But the problem with those water sprouts, those epicormic sprouts, is that they're not as well embedded into the tree. Like, sure, they can still photosynthesize. They can function like that, but they're also very weakly attached. And that's why we say no topping, because of the liability issue, is because they can break off very easily and they can hit people, hit cars, property. That's why we do not top trees.
Yeah.
It's not a good thing.
Can you, when you're looking at a tree that's under stress, and in the Central Valley, we have a lot of different stressors, primarily water and heat. Is it distinguishable what the cause is? Like, is I'm sure you could tell it's a heat issue versus a water issue and vice versa, or is it hard to distinguish? It's just, you just see a sick tree, quote unquote.
Yeah, it really comes down to the assessment and what information you can get out of your client and what they know and understand, because it can be pretty hard. I do several different trainings and classes on that. You have biotic and abiotic disorders. So biotic means things that are living, like insects, fungus, bacteria. Then you have abiotic, which are things that are not living, which is the environment, mineral deficiencies, heat. Someone runs into the tree with a car. The car is not living. So distinguishing between them it can be difficult, but generally you can figure it out pretty easily, especially looking at the leaves and the pattern on the tree. Say, oh, is this a canker disease where you have these big open lesions on the stems? Are they randomly placed around the tree on specific branches, or are they all on the sun side, like facing towards where the sun normally would be, and this is all sun scald damage? Or you look at the leaf and the leaf, it's got some damage to the right side of the leaf, but not the left. Okay, that's not very symmetrical. If it's a nutrient deficiency, usually you'll see some symmetry. You can fold the leaf in half and one side looks very similar to the other. So you're like, okay, that's probably not caused by a living issue. Living issues are much more randomized on the tree.
I see.
Yeah.
Interesting. In my conversation with Mona, again, for listeners, who's the CEO of Tree Fresno, we talked about the dire state of Valley and Blue Oaks here in California. We also talked about moves to bring up, I forget, the Mexican variety of oak that's being planted now quite a bit because it's a little bit more heat and drought tolerant. What's your prediction with what's going to happen with oaks? Do you think we're in a situation where we're going to start to see them die out en masse, or do you think it'll be something that's more kind of staggered over time?
Oh, they're gonna age out eventually. Everything comes to an end. Plus, the amount of human impacts that are around on them. They have pretty sensitive root systems. And the other thing, too, is that they keep getting injected with chainsaws. So keep cutting them down. I've seen some huge, nice valley oaks on people's properties. And since we don't have any tree ordinances to protect them, they just get cut down. It's, there goes 150 years of some really good habitat and local native species, they're gone and they're not propagating well as far as planting them and getting new ones. And plus, they grow pretty slow. Of course,
So
fire.
you also have a pretty gloomy perspective about the future of oaks, which I mean,
Yeah, it's the environment's changing.
yeah.
The place in which that they're growing is not the same. That's why coast redwoods aren't doing as well. In the valley, a lot of species aren't doing as well. Say deodar cedars. I mean, like Christmas Tree Lane, for example, all of them lined through there. Those trees should live 400 years. They're from the Himalayas. And now we've got them in Fresno. So it's like they'll survive, but they won't thrive.
I did not know that's where they're from. That's wild.
Yeah. So same thing with the valley oak. Sure, they're here in the valley, but they might not grow as well here anymore. You might start seeing them maybe live a little bit higher up. In
I
the
see.
foothills, they might no longer be down here. So maybe they might have to concentrate on planting them somewhere else with a different climate. You can see that with a lot of species going up through the foothills, up into the mountains. It's changing.
Yeah, everything is always in flux. That's true. I think it does feel like we're living through kind of this inflection point of kind of rapid change, but that just could be our perspective. I don't know. Let's talk about urban canopy a little bit. I'm going to kick you a hypothetical scenario. Let's say you could start from scratch with our urban canopy in Fresno. You're playing God with what trees line our streets. This is Ian's personal Eden of urban canopy in Fresno. How would you think about approaching creating that in the abstract? If you're trying to choose trees, mix them with each other in beneficial ways, like just give us a picture of if you're starting a city from scratch, what you would do.
So with the trees, would that also include on private property or just
Let's just say with the on city property or
city
along
property?
along the streets, if you will.
Copy that. There are some principles that we should follow, such as not having more than 10% of a particular species, 20% of a genera, or 30% of a particular family of trees. So having some variety would be great. But then also strategically looking at where they're growing. So choosing the right tree for the right spot, but then also tailoring that spot to be more tree friendly. Here in Fresno, we don't really have any ordinances or push to actually modify our infrastructure to accommodate trees. If you go to a lot of other cities, they actually, while they're building, they actually put in a lot of different strategies to accommodate, say, their root systems so they can actually grow out. They don't get, say, really pot bound, for lack of better terms, in the ground. That can happen with a lot of compaction or just too much what's called impermeable surfaces, like concrete, like roots need oxygen. So that's why you shouldn't put black plastic down whenever you're doing landscaping. Like they need water, nutrients, and oxygen. So don't, yeah, put anything that won't allow that penetration into the soil. That would definitely help to keep them alive and healthy longer. Of course, irrigation, but water's always an issue here. So maybe some more drought tolerant species. And then planting them properly for, oh gosh, yes, they need to be planted properly. I see that done improperly all the time.
Yeah. So I will say to interrupt you, Ian, it often is people's desire to have uniformity in terms of trees. Like I live on a block that has Chinese elms all the way down, and it's beautiful to look at, but what are the dangers if you have the same variety just lining a street all the way down?
Yeah, you can have a monoculture. So having a monoculture, one thing, you can actually start getting a disease or a pest in there, and then you'll just start wiping them all out because they can just go from one tree to next tree, so on and so forth. And then same thing with the shape, especially Chinese elms. When you have more rounded trees, it's actually way more expensive to actually trim those trees than say one that's a little bit more, say, pyramid shaped or maybe more oval or vase shaped. There's just way more branches to compete with that are much more out there. That's another thing to look at is just the natural shape of these trees if they want to save money when it comes to maintaining them.
Gotcha. The other week, I was planting a new fig tree in my yard, and I had to sweat some serious bullets to get that into the ground. We have a lot of hard pan in the valley and high salinity clays. We don't have not always the best soil to use. How does this soil affect tree growth?
Oh gosh, it all starts in the soil. Yeah, that's like the whole thing right now is how tree or plant health starts in the soil. So
With our particular soil composition in the valley, what are the challenges?
yeah, mostly just the hard pan. We generally around here have a sand loam or just a loam, which is actually pretty good. That's one reason why we have so much agriculture down here is because the loam is actually pretty nice to work with. A nice balance between sand, silt, and clay. But then, yeah, once you start getting that compaction, that's definitely going to be hard to get around, no pun intended. And
Is compaction worse in more dense areas in a city, like urban developed areas? Is there more compaction?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
How do you work around that, or can you work around that?
If it's new development stuff, that's where I hope that the developers consult with somebody that knows how to, if they're the goal is to have nice trees in an area, maybe not compacting everything to something that's rock hard. Yeah, again, that infrastructure to try and be more facilitating to trees while you're doing the install. Yeah, it's
You
the
drive around some
natural.
of these suburban developments, it feels like trees are an afterthought. They got heavy equipment down there compacting the hell out of that dirt. You got
Yeah.
trenching going on, all sorts of stuff. I imagine that it's pretty hard on trees and these new suburban developments out in the outliers.
Yeah, particularly in Fresno, especially for, say, if there's already developed trees or established trees, I should say, on a place or on in a location, and they're wanting to build off that location. In other cities, they have ordinances where it's required to have a arborist report that gives a preservation plan for the trees, and then they have to really rationalize why they want to remove trees. But then they have tree protection zones. I guess one thing I do, I go out and do tree protection zones for construction sites, saying you can't come within X amount of feet of this tree. If you want to cut roots, you have to consult me to be like, yes, you can cut this root or not, to try and preserve them, because you have to wait 50, 60 years for a nice tree to come back. Yeah, good luck. You better preserve what you have.
Yeah, it seems
Yeah.
like that it's it feels like more of a regulatory issue because I'm just trying to think about the incentives to a suburban developer taking care of trees. They want to build and leave. And so it feels like the rest of us to have neighborhoods we want in the future, we need to make sure that we have some rules in place to ensure we have an urban canopy going forward, even though it is going to take a number of years to develop. In talking to Mona, we talked about mulching a little bit, and she said mulching is important, but it's often done wrong, or she sees it done in strange ways, like compacting mulch and putting large piles around trees. What are the right ways to mulch a tree?
Yeah, so you don't want to put mulch right up against the base of the tree. So you should be able to see what's called the root flare on a tree. You don't want your tree looking like a telephone pole sticking out of the ground. You want to see how it tapers off to a nice wide base. So you don't want to cover up that base with mulch. That's called volcano mulching. That'll actually cause rot on the base of your tree and could kill it, stunt it, or cause it to fall over, eventually fall over from rot. But yeah, you want at least 2 to 4 inches of mulch. And they say that you should try and have it out to the drip line or the edge of the canopy, and I'm like, good luck with that. Some trees are gigantic. There goes your entire yard. So, just putting a little bit of mulch down anywhere between maybe 3 to 4 feet from the base of the trunk out, it also helps give it a buffer from, say, lawnmowers or weed whackers, because you don't want to damage your roots from those too much. And then the other thing I'll say is, like, a lot of companies, this is like a back and forth right now in the scientific community with it, is they'll offer you mulch for free because they go out and they trim trees and they have this chipper. They're like, oh, come get all this free mulch. I kind of say that might be a bad idea because they're cutting down dead, diseased trees And then you go and you put all that disease right back into your garden under your tree. And then you call me 3 years later, why is my tree dying? I'm like,
Yeah.
because you gave it a bunch of infected mulch from these people. So, yeah, I don't usually advise on that.
Yeah, I regularly will add things, organic material, compost to my garden and shrubs and plant life, but I don't often do it for trees. Am I making a mistake? Do they need that organic matter as well?
Oh, sure. Any plant will benefit from organic matter, I guess, other than air plants. They just like air.
Is it more important for younger trees versus more established trees, or all trees would benefit from just regular compost additions and things like that?
I'd say all trees. Yeah. Younger trees, of course, are going to be needing the most amount of nutrients to grow as quickly as possible. Older trees are much, they have different priorities when they start getting older. But regardless, any organic matter is going to be good for the tree. I shouldn't say any. There's plenty of organic matter that you probably shouldn't put in there, like chicken bones. Yeah.
Got it. And then you touched on irrigation for a while. I remember I spoke with an arborist a long time ago that was trying to describe the difference between surface wetting and deep soil moisture. Is that something I need to think about as a homeowner with trees, or is it just make sure to that things are watered, as you were saying before, and not just with a single drip line, but
Yeah.
and how do you discern whether you're just wetting the surface versus getting down into the ground?
Yeah, like I described earlier, like you can just simply take a shovel and you can dig. I wish there are calculations of how much water that you can do, but within this context, it's so difficult to say because everybody's soil situation is different. So that's this the easiest one. Trying to wet the entire radius of the crown, like usually out to the edge of the crown, is where you want to do. The crown is like the edge of where like the leaves and everything are. Wetting that whole area and then taking a shovel or like a little trowel and then digging down about 6 to 10 inches or so to see if it's actually wet. You don't want it to be muddy, or sometimes I can do a soil core sample and I can wring the soil out. It's just so wet. But then there's also some different products too that you can put in, are different kinds of things that kind of help you retain a little bit of water too. Some of them are from like ArborJet and stuff like that. There's some really interesting ones out there. I think it's called like Hydratain or something. But let me see here. The amount can vary considerably from tree to tree. Like usually you don't need to water your tree more than maybe once or twice a month. But the problem that we also run into is sprinklers. So trees are usually grown in a lawn setting, so they're getting overwatered a lot of times. So I
Interesting.
do see a lot of trees with root rot, and a lot of times those sprinklers are spraying water directly against the trunk, and that can cause a lot of fungal issues as well.
Okay, so would you recommend some kind of, let's say you have a tree in your front yard, it's really hard to avoid not watering it with sprinklers. What would you recommend for people?
If you've already, if, same thing, just digging down to see if those sprinklers are actually getting down deep enough. Because I keep saying 6 to 10 inches because that's where you usually find most of your fine absorbing roots is within the first 6 to 10 inches of the soil. So if your sprinklers are able to do, that's fine. But that's just part of the difficulty of doing proper care for trees is that you've got grasses right above them. A lot of times, grass is actually not good for trees, especially fescue. Fescue grass, if you got fescue grass, that's really not the best for your trees, but
Got
it
it.
looks nice. I know how it is.
Let's jump to pruning now, which is where a lot of the people that when I told them I was interviewing an arborist this week, there's lots of pruning questions. So I'll throw a couple of them at you. Why does season matter for pruning? Like when you do it?
Season can matter for species. So some species can be trimmed almost any day of the year. But most is going to be within late winter to early spring. You generally want to avoid the summer. Like there's very few trees that will actually benefit being trimmed in the summer, such as southern magnolias. Southern magnolias you can, but really you don't necessarily need to get your magnolias trimmed anyway. They don't respond well to it a lot of times. But you also, if you're going to do larger cuts, say if you need to remove a big limb from your tree, usually if it's over 4 inches in diameter, you usually want to do that in the winter in the dormant season because that's going to stress the tree out really bad. And if you do that at the wrong time, like during the spring or something, it could really stress your tree out. And even in the springtime, when the tree if is coming out of dormancy, like your deciduous trees, if you start removing way too much of those leaves too early, that can stress your tree because it's waking up. It's just used a lot of its sugar storage up and it's trying to make more, and then all of a sudden it's gone again, and it's okay. I was going to use all my energy to maybe make some chemicals to help fight off disease, but now I lost all my leaves. So now I have to spend all that energy making new leaves, and now I don't have anything left over to fight disease.
No.
So that's where the timing comes in and the amount comes in.
Huh. And I see a lot of what I would call aesthetic pruning, where it's maybe over pruning, so it looks like a certain shape or a certain way. But I know that can expose the tree to sun scalding and things like that. Is that an issue you see that's common in Fresno, or is that not really something that's extant here?
There's just so many problems with our trimming here in Fresno. I guess just to say this, I think there's about 40 known licensed tree trimming services in town, and only three of them have arborists on staff, like actual
Oh my
certified
God.
arborists.
Oh my God.
So you don't know what you're gonna get. So yeah, as far as say misshaping trees, that happens a lot. One thing I see is called lion tailing. So lion tailing is where you remove all the internal lateral branches all the way up to where you just leave like a puff ball at the end. It almost looks
Yeah.
like it's lollipopped. That is very bad and makes your tree a big hazard. Man, I see it way too much because they're
Is it
like,
that it's just too top heavy, or what is it?
yeah,
Okay.
because the limbs, they act like levers in the wind. So now you have all this weight at the end of the lever, and then that's just going to create all this extra force that can just rip it straight off of its attachment point to the actual trunk or wherever it is. And I see that way too much. It looks like they did something, but they actually made a big problem. And then that exposes all those limbs to the sun. And then that sun can bake and kill the underlying tissue of the bark and cause the
Okay.
death of the tree.
Let's do a rapid fire section. I'm going to throw a few different tree varieties at you, and you tell me something you should know in terms of thinking about pruning it or care for it. Maybe let's keep these short, like 15 to 20 seconds. We'll go through them. Crape myrtles.
They're pretty nice. I like them. There's a lot of them. They've been planting way too much, I think, of those things. They usually get aphids really bad, but really pretty. They're
Okay.
hard to kill.
In pruning terms for a crape
Pruning
myrtle?
terms?
Yeah.
Oh, not too often. Most of the time, people pollard them. They just knuckle them back. That's the easiest way to keep them. But if you let them go, keep the mitt pruning to a minimum with those things. Yeah.
Okay, maples.
It depends on the maple. There's a lot of
Okay.
different maples.
Okay, what is the most common maple in Fresno, you would say?
It's probably red maple or silver maple.
Okay, so for a red maple, how would you think about pruning and care?
So a lot of those, they can be trimmed usually within late winter to early spring. When they're younger, you can go in and cut them back a little bit more aggressively, but they have such a nice structure to them. If you can get like one good central leader going, you don't really need to do too much to them. Yeah, they can tolerate quite a bit. Maples are pretty hardy when it comes to trimming.
Okay. Western sycamore.
Oh gosh, I call them sickly moors because they
Yeah.
always look sick. I've got two in the front of my house. Sycamores, they get huge. They're really beautiful. The main thing with them is they get something called anthracnose. It's a leaf disease, and that's what causes them to defoliate so early, and they start getting thin crowns, and then their branches get all twisted, and then those branches break off and stuff like that. So I haven't seen too many new ones planted around. I think maybe because of that.
Chinese pistache. I see a lot of those as well.
Oh yeah, Chinese pistachios are great. I hardly see any problems with them. Every here and there, I'll get some interesting funguses that knock them out. The only thing is that they're the kings of girdling roots. So that's when their roots just go around in a circle. They don't really go out, and then they choke out the base of the tree, and then the tree falls over or dies. They do that pretty bad, but usually that starts in the nursery pot. So always check to make sure it's not super pot bound. But beautiful color, easy to take care of. It's just that I think we're also planting too much of those because they are so nice.
The next one you mentioned before, but I want to hear if you think it's a little overrated, magnolias, southern magnolias. I see a few of them in my neighborhood.
Yeah, so they don't grow around here. They are native to the United States, but they like draining soils and a lot of rain, which we don't have either of those here. We don't have
Yeah.
well-draining soils or a lot of rain, so I think we're gonna have to stop planting those if we want them to look nice. Sometimes I see some really nice big ones. But all the ones in my area just look so sickly. Like they
Yeah.
don't plant them in enough space and they're not watered enough. Yeah.
Okay. Eucalyptus.
Oh, eucalyptus. Yeah, they grow like a weed. They're really pretty. And yeah, you can cut some off, just cut the limbs off and do some aromatherapy in your shower with them. I've got a silver dollar maple eucalyptus in my front yard. I love that thing. But the other ones, like the lemon gums, red gums, blue gums, so the ones that get huge, I wouldn't put those near structures. They're pretty big. Their branches are usually weak, so that's why you got to keep the weight off of them. But yeah, you those things will get so huge, and you don't have to do much to them to keep them happy and healthy.
Yeah. Okay, let's jump to your work you do and a few questions about Fresno. What's the most common service you provide in Fresno, you think?
Yeah, so I'm a regional arborist with Elite Maintenance and Tree Service, so they're a very large commercial company. They do a lot of work all up and down California, and then I also do my own consulting on the side with my own business. So my function primarily is consulting. So I'm not a tree monkey anymore. I don't climb trees, run saw or anything like that. I just sell my brain.
Okay.
So if you've got questions about what's wrong with my tree, how to take care of my tree, or hey, I've got a construction project coming up and I want to protect these trees. I drive out to San Jose pretty frequently for those sorts of things because they have those tree ordinances. Another fun thing is tree appraisals. People don't know, but trees actually have a monetary value. And someone like myself, a master arborist and registered consulting arborist, I can do tree appraisals. That's just like your house or anything else. It's got a value. If you don't know what it's worth and something happens to it, you can't be compensated. Insurance companies hit me up for that sort of stuff, and attorneys. I've actually had to be an expert witness a couple times so far for different tree law related things. People don't know that, but yep, that is a thing.
That's fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah.
What are, when you're doing consulting work in Fresno, what are the most common myths you hear from homeowners about their trees?
A myth.
A myth, something that they believe that you correct through knowledge and information given your expertise.
Oh, that this is why there's always a really long disclaimer with being an arborist, which is I cannot change an act of God, essentially. I can understand and know what's going on, but thinking that it can be cured, that is not a guarantee. It's really not. Or predicting, say, oh, I want you to, this is the one. I want to plant a tree that has no risk. No risk whatsoever. I want a tree that won't damage my foundation or fall over or smash my car. And I'm like, you could have no tree. That's about as good as you get. Like, you can have low risk, but not no risk.
Yeah.
So trying to explain that is very hard sometimes.
Let's say you're giving someone advice and they live in a city. I know you said that there are three cert licensed tree trimming companies with arborists on staff, but let's say they're all booked up for the next year and you're stuck just looking through Joe Schmo tree trimmer in Fresno. What advice would you give people how to communicate what they want and how to look for a place that maybe is a little less shady or will take care of your trees?
Yeah, just be clear with what you want. I want my trees to be trimmed to the ANSI 300 standards and the best management practices from the International Society of Arboriculture, and give them a percentage of how much you want your tree to be trimmed. If it's a middle-aged tree, but it's been there for a while, it's not young, you don't usually want to trim more than 25% off the tree. If it's a mature tree, an old tree, no more than 10%. That is the recommended amount taken out from all the books that I've read on arboriculture, and say no topping. And it's just like with any other contractor. It's just like other contractors have inspectors that come in and say, yeah, that electric work is great. That deck is fine. We don't have that locally yet for tree trimming services. So you have to be the one to say, hey, that doesn't look right. And I have a problem with it. And you can resolve that how you want. But
And you mentioned at the beginning that you really valued education, knowledge building. Let's say you're just a thoughtful homeowner that wants to be more knowledgeable about tree care. What personal education routes, not pursuing becoming an arborist or anything, but personal education routes would you recommend for people that just want to be more knowledgeable and better caretakers and stewards of their trees?
Yeah, Google's fantastic. You can just Google, oh, what's the ANSI standards or whatever, or like, how's the best way to trim my tree and whatnot? You can get a lot of information that way. Of course, coming to someone such as myself, the master gardeners are a good resource. I'm going to be putting on more local free classes for people to come and learn about different tree care related things. To me, I wish it was more the tree trimming guys that would come in and get that information.
Yeah, that
You
makes
know,
sense.
yeah, because
The guys with the chainsaws.
I get some clients that are like, oh, I planted this tree, and they're like, I sorry, there's this and that, it's not like exactly correct. I'm like, but hey, it's a hobby for you, that's fine, it's part of the fun of learning a new thing. I have a problem when someone charges you $1,000 and then they don't do it. That's where I'm like, the professionals need to know how to do it, and they're not doing it right. So yeah, I'm like, if you mess up, it's a hobby. You're learning. You're having fun. Just have fun.
So we close these podcasts each time with book recommendations. Is there any tree Bibles or tree books that you think are that homeowner with trees should have in their collection, or just books that you'd like to recommend generally about the biological world or trees?
Okay. Those weren't the books I was
Oh no,
expecting.
whatever you want to recommend, Ian. I was just throwing that out there. Yeah, if you want to recommend a cool sci-fi novel, I don't care.
Yeah, no, I'm really into nonfiction.
Okay, yeah, just give us whatever. Give us whatever.
I guess if it has to do with plants
It
in a
doesn't
way,
have
there's
to. It
this
doesn't have
book.
to. I want to hear
There's
what
this
you
book.
had planned for what you'd like to recommend.
Oh, before having a kid, I used to read so much. So there's so many books. But one of my favorite ones that has to do with plants is called Of People and Plants by Maurice Meshugue. He was a famous herbalist, and he was actually Winston Churchill's personal herbalist back in the day and helped cure him of several things. But he has this amazing sort of look towards the world by using plants as medicine. And then also keeping on that same track, A Sand County Almanac by Aldo Leopold. I actually met my wife over that book from me reciting quotes from it, and she's, who's this guy? Who's this dork? But then any book by John Muir is great. But I think my all-time favorite book that I'll always refer back to is The Wisdom of Insecurity by Alan Watts. I've read all of Alan Watts's books. Love his stuff. And also another interesting one, because I used to be a wildland firefighter on a hotshot crew. One cool book is The Big Burn of 1910. It's about the United States' biggest fire. It was 3 million acres in 3 days that burned. The story of Pulaski came from that. Like, the tool named the Pulaski came from Ed Pulaski from that fire. Super neat book.
Awesome. Those are great recommendations. Ian, to close, if people need some help with trees and they want your help, where can they find it?
Yeah, you can give me a call, 559-360-3970. I'm on Instagram, either through Ashby Tree Consulting or LinkedIn, Facebook,
All the ways.
all the ways, or through Elite Maintenance and Tree Service. I'm trying to find as many avenues as possible to make myself available, because I'm, to my knowledge, I'm only one of two consulting arborists in town. Yeah, the other one is John Pape. So I'm just about trying to get people the right info, because there just aren't enough of us. And yeah.
And trees matter, and we need to take care of them. That's what makes a
Yeah.
city enjoyable to live in,
Oh, yeah.
is the greenery, the plant life, the urban canopy. So, Ian, this has been a lot of fun. I learned a lot about trees. Thanks for talking with me today.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks for listening, everyone. As always, you can support this podcast by leaving us a rating and review or by making a financial contribution at our Patreon page, which is www.patreon.com/Fresno's Best. We'll see you next time.